Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
We give a lot of thought to what we take with us when we travel, but our trips are also shaped by who we take with us and by what we leave behind. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. A few years ago, still recovering from a year of crippling anxiety, Clara Benson was just getting to know a guy she'd met on the dating site OkCupid when he invited her to go along on a 3-week trip from Istanbul to London. That alone is a date few people would sign up for so early in a relationship. But Benson's new boyfriend also had a curious way of seeing the world. No reservations, no strict itinerary, and no luggage whatsoever. Not so much as a pair of pajamas or a single change of clothing. She hadn't felt stable enough to even get on a plane for a long time. But there was something about the guy and about the prospects of seeing the world in this remarkably free way that compelled her to say yes. Clara Benson tells the story of that trip in her new memoir, No Baggage, a minimalist tale of love and wandering. Clara, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
What is different about the experience of traveling when you have no possessions to keep up with?
Well, for me, the first time I ever tried it, when Jeff and I were about to board our flight to Istanbul, I was standing in the Houston International Departures Terminal, and I felt this sense of incredible lightness. I've never felt anything like it up to that point. And it was kind of like you've forgotten something, that sense, like you left something back on the kitchen table at home, except for it's everything you've forgotten. I felt like I was about to float away. That was my first introduction to traveling with nothing.
And even the people at the ticket counter were like, "Why are you crazy?"
Yeah, they thought it was a joke. They'd never run into that before. The flight attendants on our flight, they kept coming over and questioning me, making sure I was okay, that I was sane. And, they had never run across anything like that either.
So you opened the book as you and Jeff, who was your traveling companion, were headed for the airport for this trip. And the mutual friend driving you poses this question, sort of joking, but says, "How much do you know about this guy?" I wonder if that question gave you pause.
It did. Jeff and I, when we took off on this trip together, we really only had known each other for a matter of weeks. So we had a really strong connection right at first when we met on the steps of the Texas State Capitol here in Austin. But there's a lot of practical things that you learn about someone over time that we didn't know about each other. And so taking off on this journey together, part of the travel experiment that we had set up involved our relationship, too. We weren't sure if we were going to get halfway through and realize, maybe we're not so well suited to each other after all.
Did you have an out in mind? You know, some couples go away for the weekend and realize 12 hours in that it was a bad idea. Did you have, an escape plan in mind?
We did have an escape plan. Yes, we did. We talked about it when we bought our tickets. We said, look, if we discover that we actually can't stand each other, we are just going to travel separately. We'll fly out together because our tickets are next to each other, and we'll fly back home. But in between, we'll just do our own thing.
Just so everybody understands, are you typically the person known in your circle as the one who takes risks and is afraid of nothing and just will go with the flow?
Yes and no. My younger sister says I'm the one in the family most likely to surprise. Hmm. But as you mentioned, I came out of a really rough period that lasted several years. Often it was bad enough clinical anxiety that I would have trouble leaving the house. So I think at this point, when I met Jeff, no one predicted that I would kind of celebrate my recovery by jumping onto a plane with someone I hardly knew. That was a surprise.
I thought it was so interesting, and you explore this in a really careful way in the book. The fact that you had suffered from mental illness despite a lack of some traumatic event to touch it off made you feel guilty on top of everything else, right? Our attitude in this culture sometimes is that mental illness is an indulgence for anybody who hasn't suffered some kind of terrible circumstance.
Yeah, that's true. It was, I hesitated to even talk about it while I was experiencing it because I didn't have some cataclysmic moment or really challenging upbringing that would kind of explain why I was experiencing what I was experiencing.
You characterized it to Jeff when you were first getting to know each other. It sounds like you sort of breezily said, "I have a minor mental crisis in my background." It wasn't really a minor mental crisis at all.
No, it wasn't. I actually told him at first via email while we were still just chatting on OkCupid. We hadn't met in person yet. And the last email I sent him said, "Hey, you know, I've got this on my record. I don't know if that's going to be a deal breaker for you, but here's me," basically. And in retrospect, I'm thinking, why did I tell him so quickly? You know, we hadn't even met in person. But Jeff is the kind of person who, he's not afraid of that. And in fact, he found it kind of interesting. So right after that email, he said, "Hey, let's meet in person." So I guess it worked.
And you mentioned that you met at the Capitol in Austin, but I mean, I think the way that he told you, "Okay, here's where we should meet," is something that will be copied in a rom-com any minute now. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it was super over the top, but also really sweet. He texted me the coordinates, so he didn't actually say meet me at the Texas State Capitol. He texted me coordinates that I had to plug into Google. And there's this little blue star. It's clay. It's really plain looking, actually. I'm sure most people don't notice it, on the steps of the Texas State Capitol. And he sent me a picture of the star and said, "Meet me here." And then he said, "Meet me at 7:52 p.m., which is kind of a random time. So I did. And then I saw him coming up. He's wearing these bright yellow pants, you know, making a grand entrance right from the start. And he told me later that 7:52 p.m. was the exact moment of sunset. So pretty dramatic.
Now, when you have to meet someone at 7:52, do you like get there at 7:45 and hide behind like a stone lion or something to zip in there at the right moment?
I thought about it, and I actually did get there early. I walked from my apartment, and I was so nervous that I walked, you know, I covered it in a lot less time than it would usually take me. I was practically jogging. So I did stand there alone on that star for about 10 minutes.
So there are lots of dating sites out there. For folks who don't know their Tinder from their eHarmony, how different are they, and what made you decide on OkCupid?
Well, I don't think Tinder actually existed when we met even 3 years ago, which is hard to imagine. But it's true. There's Match.com. That's kind of for people who are looking for really serious relationships, maybe marriage. And it costs a little bit of money, so it's for people who are ready to invest in finding that person. OkCupid is a little bit lower stakes. It's more casual. You've got all kinds of people on there. And then Tinder, yeah, I mean, there's lots of opinions on what that is for, but that's definitely, you just look at the picture of the person, you see almost nothing about them, and you swipe if you're interested. So like I said, that one didn't exist when we met, but who knows?
So how soon into your relationship did Jeff suggest? He had this trip already planned. How soon did he say, "Hey, you should come along"?
We talked about it in our initial emails, and we talked about it on our first date. And almost from the very start, it was kind of, there were hints about maybe, you know, kind of throwing out the possibility. But it was probably 2 or 3 weeks in. At the time, he was living down in Brownsville, Texas, on the border. He was teaching at the college there. So we had only seen each other in person maybe 2 or 3 times when he said, "Hey, you know what? Why don't you come along?"
And what did that feel like to you? I mean, I have to imagine it was flattering and exciting. Was there part of you that was screaming, this is not a good idea?
There were a couple reactions. One was surprise, because Jeff's been traveling for, you know, a decade or two, and he almost never travels with anyone else. So the fact that he was asking someone to come with him on these wild trips where he's used to making all the decisions for himself, that was a surprise. And maybe I should have felt hesitation, but I just didn't. It was such a strong feeling that I was going to be on that plane with him, that I needed to do it pretty much no matter what, that I didn't have a lot of hesitation.
So you two had this remarkable chemistry, and he's very exciting and fun and spontaneous. We should note that there were some red flags on his record, not least of which was the fact that he didn't have a home. He was living in his office, and his plans for the future were even more unusual.
Yes, so Jeff kind of thrives on pushing back against social norms. He really enjoys it. So when I met him, he disclosed that he didn't in fact have a real home. He was living in his office down in Brownsville secretly, as kind of a preparation training for his next home, which he was planning at the time. On our first date, he told me he had an alternative dwelling situation in the works. And I later discovered that he was planning to move into a 6x6 used dumpster as a science experiment for the college he eventually ended up teaching at in Austin. So yeah, red flag.
And did you think, oh, he's just messing around?
No, actually, I knew he was a strange person. And when he told me that, I just had this flash, a vision that I knew he was going to get in that dumpster. I knew he was going to do it. And I took it pretty seriously, which ended up being true. He did. He lived in a dumpster for a year after we got back from our trip.
So I have to tell you, I like to think that I travel light. I can get by for a week or more with just a backpack. Reading your book, I've been thinking about this over and over, about traveling with nothing. And there's a little bit of it that appeals to me. And then I think about all the practical realities. First of all, how does one choose, especially a woman, how does one choose an outfit that will work for everything you're going to do for 21 days?
Well, that is a question I tried to answer in the weeks leading up to our trip. I had it in my head that since I was going to be, you know, kind of roughing it and, you know, one outfit, that it had to be the perfect outfit, totally odor resistant, quick dry, all these things. And I went to a bunch of shops and tried things on, and nothing felt quite right. So I had just a few days left before our flight. I still hadn't found the thing I was going to wear. And I was at I was at Anthropology, like a dress shop. And I saw this green dress, cotton summer dress. It was beautiful. It had embroidery at the bottom. And I just thought, okay, that's it. That's what I'm going to wear. And it was totally impractical. I mean, I couldn't have picked probably a worse outfit, but I figured the trip was already so ridiculous and surreal that I might as well just play it up and go with it and see what would happen.
It's an interesting metaphor for falling in love.
It is. I think that sense of uncertainty and who knows what's going to happen, but whatever, I'm just going to throw myself in and see what happens. There's definitely a lot of overlap.
Right. And you go in with this list of qualifications, right, and the things that you're sure that you must have. And then suddenly you see the thing, you find the person that is the one or appears to be the one. And lots of people kiss a lot of frogs. And then you just go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was not looking for Jeff at all. And then he showed up and I thought, well, this is interesting. And I'm going to see where this goes. And the same thing with the trip.
We're speaking this hour with author Clara Benson. Her new memoir is called No Baggage, a minimalist tale of love and wandering. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call now at 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. And I'm also on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Clara Benson. She went to 8 countries in 21 days with a new boyfriend and no luggage. If you'd like to join our conversation about her book, No Baggage, A Minimalist Tale of Love and Wandering, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Clara, you were both traveling on a budget, but I gather you could have paid for places to spend the night along the way. There are, you know, hostels and lots of situations that are affordable for people traveling with limited means. But you guys used an app called Couchsurfing. Can you tell us how that works?
Yeah, Couchsurfing is a huge part of the way that that Jeff travels and I do too. And what it is it's a website where hosts all over the world, they open up their homes to travelers. It's free. There's no financial exchange at all, but it's designed as a cultural exchange. So the idea is you're staying with a local, you're eating with them. They might take you around the city and show you what the environment is like through their eyes. And it's a completely different way of experiencing a place. It's so different from staying in a hotel because you're outside of the tourist bubble completely. And it's so much more, there's a lot more depth. You understand the history, the politics, and you see what the day-to-day is like in a place that you've never been before.
What kind of people sign up to offer their couches? It seems like there are lots of nice, generous people who would still be wary of this.
Yeah, the first time I did it, I was also wary. And like anything that you do, you have to have a certain degree of caution and following your intuition. The website, they have some protections in place. There's a rating system and a review. Couchsurfing, they check your home address, and so there you have a pretty reasonable sense by looking at someone's profile whether they're a good match or not. So that's what we do. We look at someone, and if we have a connection, we send a few emails back and forth, and then we show up at their front door and go from there.
So you guys touched down in Istanbul, your first destination, and you had put out some queries on Couchsurfing but hadn't heard from anybody. And you were a little bit concerned, like, where are we going to, you know, sleep tonight? And Jeff was not concerned at all.
Yes. I mean, obviously, somebody that's going to live in a dumpster is willing to. I had this feeling like he was going to stick to our experimental guidelines, which were, you know, no hotels. We have to stay with a local. If we can't find one, then what? So I imagined us sleeping on a park bench or who knows what. So we landed in Istanbul, and my plan was to find some sort of internet access, send out a bunch of messages, get organized, figure out where we were going to stay. And Jeff, meanwhile, after this really long flight, says, well, let's just get on the train and go downtown, and we're just going to get off at a random train station and just wander around and see what happens. You know, he was really taking the theme of the trip seriously right from the first moment. So I said, you know what? This time, we'll try it. We'll get on the train, and if it's miserable, then maybe we do it my way. So we did. We got on the train and we wandered around the old town in Istanbul for a couple hours. It was incredible. I mean, so much going on all around us, colors and crowds and food. But we still had no place to stay. And so right at the last moment, the sun is going down. I say, okay, we're going to an internet cafe, which we do. And he checks his email, and he had an email from a friend he had met couch surfing a couple years earlier in Kazakhstan. And his friend Mohammed said, "Hey, I've got a space at my place. I also happen to be in Istanbul right now. And do you guys need a couch?" So that night, that's how it worked out.
Are there nights when you are exhausted and don't want to communicate with your host, even though they might be the loveliest person in the world? And how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the tougher things about staying with somebody. And I'm an introvert, so I need that time alone to recharge and not have to have a conversation. And so what I've decided is the trade-off for having that local experience and seeing things I would never know to look for on my own is worth the occasional tired nights when I don't feel in the mood to have a conversation. But a lot of the couchsurfing hosts often, they understand too. And they're like, yeah, fine, just take a nap. You don't have to talk. They get it. They're often travelers as well.
Was anybody shocked that you stayed with that you guys showed up with nothing?
I mean, to be a couchsurfing host, to welcome people that you don't know into your home, you have to be a certain kind of laid-back person.
So, prepared for anybody.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone was shocked. I think they found it pretty funny, though, and they wanted to kind of get involved. So they would let us borrow their clothes while ours were in the wash, or give us sheets to wrap ourselves up in. You know, they were in on the game.
So being lost can be really exciting if you don't have somewhere to be. It can be incredibly stressful if you do. And there's a point in the book where you're supposed to be navigating and it's going badly. And I identify with this completely because I have a terrible, I just cannot read a map, and under stress it's worse. And people who love me very much have screamed at me in moments where I'm supposed to be navigating. And you had that same experience.
Yes, I have a terrible sense of direction. It's really bad. I tell myself it's because I'm attuned to other things that are just as important but are not particularly useful from getting from point to point. On this trip, Jeff and I were exploring the idea of being lost, and we experienced it in different forms. Times where we, like you said, made space for just wandering in a city that we'd never been to before, not knowing where we were with no map. Which is a really incredible experience, because it's very rare. There's so few times now with Google Maps and everything where you don't know exactly where you are. But then, yes, we also had times where we did have to make a train or we're trying to get to a city far away. We had one instance when we were hitchhiking that we could not get to the freeway we were supposed to be at for starting our hitchhiking journey, and it was stressful. And that's a really good way to get to know someone, too, is when you're trying to navigate together.
There's, you know, lots of couples have to figure out, okay, what are our biorhythms, right? Does somebody like to get up early? Does somebody like to sleep late? And you all had to deal with this. And one of the things you realized was that you each had sort of different expectations, and you had to decide, okay, am I going to communicate this? Am I just going to do what I want? And there were some, you know, questions about what time you would get up and go see the ruins.
Yeah, so Jeff and I, we were basically learning each other's rhythms while we were on this trip, and we quickly discovered that he likes to get up before dawn and rush out the door. He likes to see a city as the sun is rising. People are just opening their shops and putting out the chairs and things. That's his kind of magic hour. And I require a lot of sleep, so I tend to get up later. I like to move slowly in the morning. It's my meditative time. So right off the bat, we had to figure out which way we were going to do it. And so, you know, there were some moments of tension figuring that out and saying, look, I need this and I need this. And we did figure out a balance by the end of the trip. And it involved sometimes doing it his way and sometimes doing it my way.
Well, I was thinking about it because if you've been a couple for a long time, maybe by the time you go on a trip like this, you've already sort of tacitly agreed, okay, we'll split up for three of these 12 days or whatever it may be. But you know, early on, you still want to be with the other person. You don't necessarily want to do what they're doing.
It's true. Also, and you don't want to introduce conflict so early on. You're kind of on your best behavior when you've just met someone. You don't want to have the conversation of, well, I don't really like your idea. Let's do it my way. So we were kind of tiptoeing around each other at first. And then there were moments when the tension got to the point where it was time for a conversation. So I always say that traveling with someone, it's like pressing fast forward on a relationship in terms of what you have to deal with right away.
We have an email here from Kelly who says, surely you took something, a toothbrush at least. What else and how and where did you carry it?
I did bring a toothbrush. Jeff brought half of a toothbrush. He's really dedicated minimalist, so he cut a toothbrush in half. And since I did wear that green dress, I had no pockets, so I ended up bringing a very small side purse. And in it, I had my passport, I had a stick of deodorant, toothbrush, I actually did have a spare pair of underwear, And just a very few toiletries, eye contact, lens solution. But that was about it. And Jeff, he did not have any spare underwear. And what he did have, he just put in his back pockets. That was it.
You discover that you guys had different standards with regard to like how often you would shower and how often you would wash that, in his case, one pair of underwear.
Yes, again, like the dumpster red flag thing, I knew hygiene wasn't his thing. And he actually has this face when he's cleaning or taking a shower. And it's just like this little boy in distress. He really doesn't like bathing very much. So, and I do. I shower every day. Going into this trip, I was really worried about my cleanliness. Worried that I'd be in all these beautiful places around the world and just be filthy and stinky. But thankfully, it really wasn't that big of a deal to stay clean. Wherever we were staying, if there wasn't a washing machine, we just used water and soap in the sink. It's a little more work, but not that big of a deal. Hang it to dry overnight and then put the clothes back on in the morning.
I want to talk about this because you acknowledge in the book that you were both well aware that as, you know, middle class educated people with American passports, this was a choice for you to live with no possessions as opposed to, you know, many, many people in the world who don't do that by choice. It's just how they have to subsist.
Yeah, absolutely. That is something that Jeff and I talk about all the time, which is travel, leisure travel is definitely a privilege. And choosing to go without for a set amount of time, you know, 3 weeks, at the end of it, we get to go back to our home with all of our stuff. That is that's a privilege, too. And we were very aware of that while we were traveling together. And we met a lot of people that had very little, but it was, you know, their life. And so we were careful to frame it as a social experiment that we were doing to challenge ourselves and within the context of, you know, travel in general.
Do you travel alone?
I have never traveled internationally alone. I do travel within the U.S. alone several times a year, and it's something I really value. Traveling alone is such a different thing than traveling with a partner. People interact with you differently. You choose every piece of what happens on the way. And so I recommend both forms of both traveling with someone and working with that, figuring it out, and then traveling on your own.
So Jeff comes across as a guy, and you describe him explicitly in the book as a guy who really doesn't, at the time that you all did this trip, wasn't interested in being tied down or defining your relationship, but, you know, wanted to be like free as he could possibly be. But he had been married before and had a daughter. And so clearly there was an aspect of his life that was very much about obligation and responsibility.
Yeah, so that's one of the big dynamics in the book, one of the tensions between us as we're traveling and growing closer together over the course of this trip is, you know, what does this mean for him and for me? What happens when we get back? Is this just kind of a random lark that we went off and had this trip and this experience together, and then when we get back, it's over? You know, we were in the early stages of our relationship, so we had no labels. It was kind of a modern arrangement, I guess. And it was tough because you can have these ideals of freedom and independence, and we don't need any labels. We're just going to see what happens. But as you get closer to someone and it's reality, it's practice, it's a little tougher. And we definitely experienced that over the course of our trip.
Yeah, no labels sounds great while you also want to keep your options open. But as soon as you know that, like, you're really interested in somebody, it would seem like you want a label right away.
Yeah. There's a moment in the book where we're on a bus trip towards the end of the trip. Yeah. Having this conversation of like, what is going on here? And I knew that I wasn't expecting a relationship when I met him. But after a few weeks, I was thinking there's really something here. And I wanted a little bit more definition. And, you know, he was hesitant to go there because he, you know, he had this idea that he was just going to be free and run around doing whatever he wanted. And So yeah, that's something that we've continued to explore. We've been together 3 years now. And so we do have a lot more definition now.
Well, you met this woman, I don't know if it's going too far to call her like a manic pixie dream girl, but this French woman on this bus, and Jeff just seemed sort of taken with her. Not I don't know how flirty it was, but you're sort of silently fuming at this whole thing, and it appeared that he didn't even notice that you were upset by the exchange that they were having.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, part of our experiment was that in addition to our trip having no guidelines or itineraries or plans, we were applying that same set of rules to ourselves. So we said, you know, it's totally open. We're just going to, you know, be in the moment and do whatever we want. And at that moment when I saw him, what I thought was flirting with this other woman on this bus, a painter, I was like, well, I actually don't know if that's going to work. Again, it sounds better in your head and, you know, like as a philosophy than it does when it comes down to the nitty gritty real life. So that was a learning moment for me.
You were so relieved to see her paintings and realize they weren't very good.
They weren't very good. Yeah, I feel a little bit ashamed to say that I felt some sort of smug satisfaction when I saw her artwork.
As it turns out, he really wasn't interested in her.
No, he's just a social butterfly, and he was shocked later when I told him that I was feeling jealous and upset. He hadn't noticed because he was oblivious. He was talking to everyone on the bus, and I was tired and probably reading too much into it. He was shocked when I told him why I was upset.
We're speaking this hour with writer Clara Benson about her new memoir, No Baggage, a minimalist tale of love and wandering. It's the story of a trip she took to 8 different countries over 21 days with a guy she had just met. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Clara Benson. We're talking about her memoir, No Baggage, a minimalist tale of love and wandering. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Clara, since you were sort of recently recovered from a long period of really difficult struggles with anxiety, did you trust your own mind as you were falling in love with Jeff? Like, did you feel like the trip was maybe just as much trying to escape what you had been feeling before you started getting better as anything else?
You know, I thought a lot about what was going on in my head as this whole process unfolded. And I would say that that I thought of the trip more as of a celebration or as a test of how far I had come from barely being able to leave the house and unemployed, barely functioning, to taking off on this journey with no certainty of what would happen. But it wasn't without some hesitation. I was worried that maybe I would relapse and have an anxiety attack while I was traveling, or if I'd get there and find out, no, I actually wasn't stable enough or ready to take on that big of a challenge for where I was at. My family was definitely a little concerned when I told him I'd met this guy on the internet and we were taking off, and my finances also had just begun to stabilize. I had a full-time job for the first time in years that I actually quit to take this trip. So they were concerned that I was in over my head. But like I said earlier, I knew all that and I registered it and took note and decided that I was going to do it anyway.
So you mentioned that you and Jeff are still together, and I wonder if you've read that research that says that, like, early in a relationship, having an experience that is incredibly novel for both of you is a way to sort of guarantee that you fall in love. And I wonder if you think that had anything to do with it.
I haven't heard that research. I'd love to look into that. That's interesting. I think that an adventure of this kind is so intense that it's either make or break, right? I mean, there was a real chance that we could have gotten to Istanbul and within a day or two just totally melted down. And that would have been obvious pretty quickly. It's a bonding experience to take two people and put them in this unknown environment and have them work together to make it through and to have to form a partnership to do that, I think is really powerful.
In terms of your itinerary, you knew that you were flying into Istanbul and that you were going to be departing out of London, but in between there, you ended up literally wandering into countries that you hadn't necessarily planned to visit.
That's true, yeah. Before we went, Jeff, he had this paper map of Turkey and the Balkans, Eastern Europe, and he cut out the region that we kind of guessed that we'd be sticking within. And actually, we were going to go to Belgrade in Serbia. And the bus was full from Athens, which is where we were, about midway through the trip. And so he looked at the map and we looked at each other and said, okay, well, we can't go there. Where else should we go? And he actually tried to get the ticket lady to choose for us, just randomly pick
a
bus.
She was like, I'm not going to do that.
She refused. Yeah, she's like, no, I'm not going to choose for you. You have to choose. So I kind of randomly pointed to Budapest and she said, okay, be here at this time, and it's a 23-hour bus ride. You're going to Budapest. And we didn't even have Hungary on our map that Jeff had cut out because we didn't expect to be going there.
We have a tweet here from Maddie who wants to know, were there any souvenirs you wanted to grab but could not?
That's a question I get a lot, is the souvenir thing. I think it was such a big deal to decide going into this trip that I'm not bringing anything. I'm not buying anything, you know, unless it's essential, that it just completely took away the focus and the desire on possessions, pretty much period. And so I knew I couldn't bring anything home, so I didn't even look. And, you know, in trips that we've done since, one thing that we will do is at the very last city that we go to, the last day, we'll go to the local market and just pick up a few gifts or handmade artisan things and put them in a bag and throw it on the plane and bring it home. But sometimes we go on trips and we don't bring anything back, and I've honestly never missed it. The memories are so incredible and powerful that I'm completely happy to just have those.
How do these experiences affect the way you approach people in terms of trust? Because you had to really trust Jeff. I mean, you did know him and you knew that he was somebody really special and unlike a relationship you'd had before, but you had to trust him, and then you had to trust strangers along the way, and you're really relying, if you're in a place where you know don't necessarily speak the language, you're just relying on a lot of people who have no particular reason to be kind to you, but often are.
Yeah, and that is one of the things that we set out to explore on this trip. We wanted to test a few different things, and one of them is the idea of intuition, of dropping into a situation where there's unfamiliar elements around you and being able to navigate in the moment in a way that feels good and right. And so, yeah, of course, that involves all the people around us. I think both Jeff and I are really good judges of people. You can learn a lot by looking into someone's eyes. And we're both really experienced travelers as well. And you can just get a feel for if there are certain areas you shouldn't be in or if something feels a little off, paying attention to that and leaving if you need to. And then the opposite side of that, too, is being open and being willing to talk to somebody or try to talk to them with hand motions or whatever. I think, generally speaking, most people are open to that. At least that's been true from my experience.
So you were really drawn, in some ways, to Jeff's pushing back against social conventions. There were some times, though, when he would do something just to sort of be wild, like drying his underwear on the, was it the Parthenon? Where was it that he...
Yes, it was at the Parthenon.
Yeah, tell that story.
This is the one of the moments when I'm thinking, no, baggage is a really bad idea. So the morning that we were in Athens, like I said, Jeff likes to wake up really early. And if there are tourist destinations, these big, you know, like the Parthenon, he wants to see them right when they open at dawn, when the cruise ships haven't docked yet. And so we woke up early, our clothes hadn't dried from the night before. And so he just put his underwear in his pocket instead of on. And we raced up the steps to the top of the Parthenon, and it was really an incredible moment. We had the whole thing to ourselves, the Acropolis. Definitely a moment that stands out in my memory. Sunrise. But as it started heating up and the crowd started arriving, he went off on his own for a little bit. And I had this feeling like he was up to something bad. And so it's like that intuition thing again. And so after a few minutes, I looked around and I saw his hat. He was wearing a Stetson, his grandfather's Stetson, kind of bobbing low to the ground. And I saw his underwear, red underwear, on this line, like a railing next to this ancient pillar laying on its side. And I'm thinking, oh, no. So I went over there and I said, this is no, you can't do this. And a guard also saw him and yelled, respect, and came after us. And so we had to pack up and go right back down that staircase and leave the Acropolis. And that was one of those moments where I'm thinking, okay, you took that too far. You need to be on better behavior.
Did you get a sense of why he likes to take things too far while you were on this trip? I mean, I know you know him much better now.
I think most of the time he really is trying to, again, push back on what we consider acceptable and normal. And most of the time he has a good gauge on how far to go and no farther. But every once in a while he misgauges and does take it a little too far. And that was definitely one of those moments. But I mean, one of his favorite philosophers, Diogenes, who almost certainly was at the Acropolis way back then, did all sorts of crazy shenanigans up there too. So I think he was also trying to channel his favorite philosopher by doing that.
So I've been thinking about you taking no extra clothes. You did have like a scarf shawl thing, pretty thin, but you could throw it over your head or your shoulders. Your dress was sleeveless. I think I wouldn't feel comfortable traveling without like a jacket in case it rains or it gets cold or, you know, how often did the weather cooperate and what did you do when you were like physically uncomfortable?
That was actually a concern that a lot of people had before our trip was cold. And so we didn't know. A lot of the things that were going to happen to us on this trip, we didn't know how we were going to handle them. We figured we'd figure it out in the moment. So that's what we did. We were lucky that we were traveling during summer, so the climate, especially around the Mediterranean countries, was pretty steady, 70, 80 degrees. I was always comfortable then. We were warm pretty much everywhere we went, except for towards the end of our trip when we landed in Edinburgh, in the UK. We had a couple cold mornings, and I borrowed a sweater from the family that we were staying with. But Jeff, he wanted to find something more organically, I guess. So we were going on our walk around the city for the day, and he saw this old sweatshirt on a bench that someone had left, and he considered it like divine coincidence or something. It was the sweater that he'd been needing. So he picked it up and put it on and wore it the rest of the day.
What did it feel like when you finally came home and put on other clothes?
I'm not going to lie. It was wonderful. Putting on something else. I mean, that dress, I wore it for 21 days straight and it got ripped. And
you were like devastated when it got ripped.
I was because it had been through a lot with me. And so I hung it up in my closet. I knew I would never wear it again. I still have it. But I was happy to come home to a full wardrobe and not have to think about, okay, is my underwear clean? Do I need to wash it, hang it out to dry? But yeah.
I don't get the sense that you were a particularly acquisitive person before, but I wonder how that first experience of traveling with nothing might have changed your relationship to your possessions in general.
It did. It really did. I came home and I knew that I wanted to clear out a lot of the possessions I had, because that feeling of the experience and being in the moment and not concerned about my possessions, either guarding them or finding new ones, it was so freeing that I wanted to bring some of that home with me. So I came home and I went through my closet, through my kitchen, through my books, and I got rid of about half of my things and gave them away. And I didn't miss any of it, and I still have a very minimalist home.
Would you recommend traveling with no luggage to someone who thinks it sounds interesting but also scary?
I'm careful with recommending what I did to other people. You know, it was more of a thought experiment and a personal challenge for Jeff and I. I do know a lot of travelers who do go very minimally, not that minimally, but a backpack and just they trim everything down to the very bare essentials. And I do think that is a wonderful way to travel. So, you know, somewhere in there, sure. And I would say that if you're interested in trying it, it's not as hard as it seems. There are a few things on my website. I've got a list of do's and don'ts if you do want to try it. But it's, you know, it's not that hard.
But you would say take toothpaste no matter what your new boyfriend tells you about how you won't need it.
Absolutely. Do not leave home without the toothpaste.
Is there any place you wouldn't go luggage free? I mean, let's assume it's not a wedding where you need a dress or whatever.
Well, one thing that we've done this trip now 4 times, actually, we've done it 5 times total. And we had to learn the hard way that going to different climates, it presents some challenges if you only have one outfit. So we went to South America and I had these snow boots that were perfect for the Andes. But then we ended up in the Atacama Desert near the Nazca Lines. And it was just ridiculous. It was totally miserable. So I say if you do a no baggage trip, try to aim for one climate. If I do it again in the future, I'm not going to go somewhere that has a lot of hot and cold or wet and dry, because it's just too much.
Clara Benson's memoir is called No Baggage, A Minimalist Tale of Love and Wandering. Clara, thank you so much for joining us and happy travels.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect has been a wonderful associate producer for a long time and is moving on to her next adventure. We're going to miss her. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org, and I'm on Twitter. The handle is @ChrisBoydThink. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.